may proceed. I understand you have 20 minutes per side, is that correct?
That is the publication on your call, and I don't know why, Your Honor. I noticed it on the call, but I didn't prepare that way.
No one requested 20 minutes, did they?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
10 minutes.
Can both parties do their arguments in... Well, all right, we'll proceed on whatever you need. How much time are you going to need, Counsel?
I don't think I'll need 20 minutes.
Okay, all right. Let's proceed then.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm here on behalf of Gary Johnson, whose wife was killed in a motor vehicle collision. Two of his children were injured in that motor vehicle collision, one seriously, the other less seriously. Mr. Johnson has a third child who was not injured in the collision. The collision date is May 15, 2003. 20 months later, a federal tort claim was filed. The defendant driving the other vehicle was in the United States Air Force. 30 months later, a lawsuit was filed. By 40 months later, the lawsuit had been filed and Rule 26 initial disclosures had been exchanged and the Johnson family members had been deposed. And at that point, Mr. Johnson changed lawyers. 47 months later, the case was settled. Before the change in lawyers, the United States made an offer to settle the case for $1.5 million. Mr. Johnson's first lawyer urged him to accept that amount, that is, for all of the claims, the death claims and the personal injury claims. In mediation with a second lawyer, the case settled for $2.9 million. And in that process, Mr. Johnson, and with the advice of his second lawyer, was urged to present to the county court his request that the total attorney's fees for the compensation of the lawyers be capped at 15%. There was a different contingent fee agreement in place with the first lawyer. The county court agreed. The attorney's fees were determined to be worth a total of 15% of the recovery, and the issue on remand from this court then was how should those funds be divided. It's Mr. Johnson's position that the division should be two-thirds to his second lawyer and one-third to his first. Now, I'd like to explain some of why Mr. Johnson feels that way and start with mathematics.
Before you do that, Counsel, could you tell us just briefly about the accident and what occurred?
I will, Your Honor. Okay. This was an open intersection collision. Involving an absolutely flat and completely clear and visible view by each driver. Mrs. Johnson had the directional right-of-way, which of course counted for nothing because it was an open intersection with a plain view for each driver. It was a relatively low-speed collision, and there really isn't any good accounting for why the drivers didn't see one another, but they didn't. They collided, and she was killed. Her death appears to have been instantaneous. And I might add to that for just a moment that one of the children, Victoria, suffered an open skull brain injury, had a remarkable recovery, is in school, and is doing quite well under the circumstances.
So the complexity was as to, if there was complexity, was as to the damages. This was a standard open intersection collision.
There was nothing complicated about the liability facts, Your Honor. There was really not as much contest about liability as you would expect. The government really didn't push the burden the other way. In fact, the government never contended that there should be an apportionment as to the children's claims. So the liability feature of the case was pretty straightforward. The dollar amounts, if you can see that, are interesting. The first lawyer said settle it for $1.5 million, and it settled for $2.9 million. With the reduction in the attorney's fees from a maximum of 25% in the original lawyer's fee agreement was up to the county court to approve, to 15%, actually 53% of the money the Johnson family got came from the $1.4 million added as a result of the efforts of the second lawyer, and 47% came from the $1.5 million that was as a result of the efforts of the first lawyer. That's the first thing that Mr. Johnson would like to have you know. Second, it's true and it's important, but not determinative, that Mr. Johnson had a good professional relationship, he says, with his second lawyer and did not with his first. You've decided in the state of Nicholson that the lawyer, that the client's expressions on a division of fees should be given deference but should not be controlling. And I think what that means is if the client, and you've said this about personal representatives as well, has a rational basis for the proposed division, that rational basis is entitled to deference, non-controlling deference. But if there's no rational basis, if there's rage or anger or misunderstanding or something else, no deference is in order. Mr. Johnson details why he was dissatisfied with the first lawyer in Exhibit 21, and he has an extensive laundry list there. It ranges from the way the tort case was handled to the way the estate case was handled to some of the conduct and behavior along the way. There is no question that the first lawyer provided value. He got the tort claim filed timely. It took a while, but he got the lawsuit filed timely. He collected the medical records. He contacted the treating physicians who were the primary expert witnesses in the case, not the only ones. He chose to engage an economist, a decision with which the second lawyer disagreed because the decedent was a non-income producing person, and there was a perception that that might not be very helpful evidence, but he chose to do that. And respect is due that he made a professional judgment about whether that was the right thing to do or not. He also recommended the use of a family counselor who became a witness. I think that's the only expert we know of who he identified. Mr. Johnson says his approach to the witnesses caused some problems with the witnesses, and those were undone by the second lawyer. When the county court got this case back from you after your first remand, there was no new evidence presented. The hearing that happened there was only a few minutes long, and it was only a very brief argument by the lawyers. The court signed an order presented
How did that occur? Did counsel request a hearing, or did...
The court simply issued an order and scheduled a hearing, Your Honor. I don't think we had to request one. The court was prompt at doing that work. Court decided that the fee division should be 85% to the first lawyer and 15% to the second. And that 85-15 is driven by the county court's indulgence in this math. Number one, the county court gave the first lawyer credit for producing $2 million, not $1.5 million, in funds on the table. And second, the county court divided the fee as to the $900,000. That $367,000 award to the first lawyer is $67,000 more than the first lawyer would have received in fees if the case had settled at $1.5 million, which was his recommendation, and if the fee had been 20%, which is what the federal statute it should be, says it should be on a settled federal tort claim, maximum. So he would have received $300,000 if the case had settled the way he wanted it to settle. He received $367,500 from the county court, and it settled for double what he recommended.
Where did the county court obtain the $2 million figure that you mentioned?
Your Honor, in an affidavit from the first lawyer said that he had an offer for $1.5 million, but he believed it would easily go to two. That's all. It was his opinion that would happen. I'm not aware of any other evidence on that. In the first appearance before this court, Justice Stephen, you observed that this is probably a case about trying to figure out what each lawyer contributed. I want to focus on the first component of Section 2652 of Chapter 30 of the Nebraska Statutes, which says that the first consideration in establishing attorney's fees is the time and labor and the novelty and the skill involved. It's important that although lawyers have given themselves over to billing by the hour, a regrettable circumstance that the American Bar Association has said is disappearing, fortunately, we focus too much on time and not on labor and novelty and skill. It makes sense that the equation include more than time. If an earth-moving machine can level a piece of land in 2 days, but it takes $1,000 an hour, and a person can do it in a lifetime with a spade, it might be appropriate that the compensation is nearly the same. the task and the accomplishment are the same. The time is much different. And so it is too with lawyers. We really don't sell number two yellow corn or meat by the pound. We aren't in strictly the commodities business. A lot of the practice of law is commodity work. A lot of it is, but not all of it. And not the subjective component of valuing a case and selling it for damages. So in this case, it's important, I think, that the court give life to that first part of Section 2682 and adjust this fee more equitably. The second thing is that in this case, the county court clearly did not give any deference to the client, not even facial deference. This is a man who lost his wife, had his family dramatically disrupted, a successful farmer and a good operator. There's no doubt about that. There also is no doubt about the fact that he was a good father, except that his first lawyer attacked him after the settlement, and he believes engendered some serious disruption, not only in his family, but in these legal proceedings as a result, and that may account for a bit of the reason that he doesn't think this lawyer ought to be paid very much. This record will disclose an affirmative statement on the record to the court at the first hearing before the first appearance here that the first lawyer was not authorized to advocate against Mr. Johnson on the matter of how funds should be divided and distributed among his family members. And then he shut up. Now, that really doesn't have anything to do with the division of the fee. It just is background for what's going on. This is a case in which your judgment is invoked on two grounds. First, you have a standard of review here that is very favorable to the appellee. You review for an error on the record. You ask, did the trial court abuse its discretion? And in this case, I think that standard may be a little bit unfortunate because of the subject matter, but it is the standard. And in this case, we respectfully contend that the trial court did abuse its discretion. It did consider time and only that. It did indulge in an assumption about what the recovery should be, an assumption projected from an affidavit about what a lawyer thought might be. And it didn't give deference to the rational explanation of the client.
Refresh my memory. How many hours it was?
I'm sorry, I can't help you because I don't remember. Okay. I don't know. And I can tell you that the second lawyer didn't identify hours and didn't record hours and didn't present a claim based on hours.
So the first lawyer gave, according to the order, is that correct? The first lawyer gave a detailed time accounting.
That's true. I can tell you, because I did look at this yesterday, Justice Conway, that after the first lawyer got notice from the client that the second lawyer was engaged and the first lawyer was to stand aside, there are, I think, 109 entries for 149 hours of service billed. What we want the court to do is to make an equitable division of the fee. My job here today as Mr. Johnson's advocate is to explain why he thinks two-thirds, one-third is appropriate. I have nothing more to offer the court about his view of that. I have no other view than Mr. Johnson's to present. Therefore, I'm finished.
Two-thirds, one-third of the total settlement or the amount exceeding $1.5 million?
His position, Your Honor, is that it should be two-thirds of the total fee and one-third of the total
fee. But the fee calculated against the entire amount?
That's correct. Okay.
Thank you. Better move that a little closer.
Is
Well, that'll work. Thank you. You may proceed.
Yeah, please, the court. I'm Mike Chaperonik, and I represent the appellee, Monty Nealon. We see this case somewhat differently than the appellant did. In this particular case, even using Mr. Domina's figures, there were 570 hours that preceded the retention of Mr. Domina. There was an offer of $1.5 million that the evidence showed that Mr. Nealon said to reject, and that's what the county court found. The county court had an opportunity to see Gary Johnson and to believe him or not believe him, and chose not to believe him on many matters. Mr. Nealon's affidavit also said there was a hint of a $2 million offer, and the U.S. government had agreed to settlement before Mr. Domina was on the case, and that was communicated to Mr. Johnson. That was in July, before Mr. Domina was hired in August. Mr. Domina was hired in August, and this case went to mediation in March. There was no written fee agreement. There was no fee agreement at all until the mediation. And if it was a contingent fee agreement, there's an ethical requirement that it be in writing. This court found that there was no need for that because it was not a contingent fee, and therefore there was no risk premium that Mr. Domina is entitled to. The ethical rules also require that you to have a agreement, whether oral or written, within a reasonable period of time, and yet Mr. Domina did none. And
was there some understanding with respect to the first lawyer that after the second lawyer made an appearance that the first lawyer was to do or not do things?
Mr. Domina requested that Mr. Nealon stay on the case, do depositions, and there was a letter from Mr. Johnson saying work the out among yourselves. There was an understanding between Mr. Nealon and Mr. Domina that they would work it out based on the actual work that was done, not the result, and that comports with the ethical code.
So is this correct with respect to the first lawyer's time, which is something upon which the order relied, that two-thirds of it was before and one-third was roughly, two-thirds was before and roughly one-third was after the engagement of the second lawyer?
I didn't look at the actual timesheets to weigh that way, but if, assuming Mr. Domina's figures were correct, there would have been about 570 hours before, and there would have been about 140 hours afterwards. And if we look at it this way, if the fee was, if the government was hinting at an understanding, Mr. Nealon thought there was going to be at least $2 million on the table and they agreed to mediation, then all that remained would have been the $900,000, for which Mr. Nealon would have put in 140 hours. And I believe my recollection of Mr. Nealon's attempt to take the units of value and put time to them, that was about 114 hours by Mr. Domina. So even after Mr. Domina came into the case, Mr. Nealon still put in more time, if we assume that his attribution of time to the units of value was correct. When we get to there's two parts here. First of all...
But you're not urging us to just look at time, are you? I mean, is that what you're urging?
No, I'm urging you to in the primary instance of what on remand is the county court did exactly what you told it to do, and this is the county court's journal entry, and first thing they looked at was the results obtained, and so obviously you're going to look at more than time for what the results obtained, and then where did it come from? And so the county court essentially found that Mr. Nealon brought the value of the case up to $2 million, and then they split the time on the remaining $900,000, and that's what it did. But the court did exactly what this court urged it to do, which is essentially take what's in the ethical code and then apply that to what an attorney should do, and then they did it, the quality of the work. One of the things that, it's true it was an open intersection accident, but one of the issues about that was whether or not Mrs. Johnson was lighting a cigarette, and there was accident reconstruction on that. So it's a little bit more than the simple open intersection case because there was some accident reconstruction. And the government was convinced, apparently after the motor vehicle homicide charges were filed, that that they should be paying some money, and they in fact did. The quality of the work, One of the things that's interesting about this case is Mr. Dominick chose not to offer any expert testimony about the quality of the work done by either lawyer, and chose to rely on Mr. Johnson. A lot of the things that Mr. Johnson said in court were essentially not believed by the county judge, who had a chance to observe Mr. Johnson.
And if you look at who are the expert witnesses in this case?
The expert witnesses on fees were Paul Hoffmeister, Jim Chata, and a lawyer from Colorado named Steve Ray, who's also licensed in Nebraska.
Was there anything to dispute in the record that disputed the affidavit that there was an offer from the government of $2 million and then $2 million, and it was communicated to Mr. Johnson?
I don't believe so.
Sure. Did Mr. Johnson deny that that Neyland informed him of the $2 million offer?
I don't recall that he did, Judge.
I'm sorry, was there a $2 million offer?
He had a $2 million offer.
Well, what does that mean?
Well,
I'm not sure.
What I meant was that it's kind of like that that it wasn't a formal offer. It was an inquiry as to will you take it, and that's all that I can say. There was a hint, because that's what Mr. Neyland said in his affidavit, and that's pretty common to try to feel out the other side as to what they might do.
Well, that's using a crystal ball.
I don't know that it's a crystal ball so much as it's feeling people out, and that was the sense that Mr. Neyland got. What he put in his affidavit was that that they were feeling out whether or not Mr. Neyland would be willing to take that, because he was not willing to take the 1.5 or recommended his client take the 1.5 million.
Okay, so the offer was 1.5 million, and there was a dance after that, as there is in settlement. So
that's correct.
Okay.
The lawyers, after contributing to the result, here Mr. Neyland provided evidence from third parties not affiliated with the case, describing Mr. Neyland's efforts as key to the end result. On the other hand, Mr. Johnson's satisfaction with Mr. Neyland led for him to hire Mr. Dominick, and he was very, very satisfied. Time and labor, Mr. Neyland provided detailed records. Mr. Dominick chose to express his estimated time in the case with no real explanation of the units of value or how the units would correlate to his out-of-pocket expenses totaling $1,000, where Mr. Neyland and his firm had put in $55,750 in out-of-pocket expenses. The court also considered the legal issues and skill required. When you have a brain injury case, those automatically get complicated. There was a disagreement on whether or not to use an economist, and if one of the things that you always try and do is to get as much specialty image as you can, and that's one of the reasons why you would use an economist, and you use them in any case you can. I would think that they make sense to do. Mr. Dominick chose to offer no evidence outside of Mr. Johnson's testimony. The lawyer's experience, reputation, and ability. Mr. Neyland provided evidence from third parties not affiliated with the case, describing his excellent reputation as a trial lawyer, outstanding legal ability, willingness to accept the risk presented by this case, both in time and out-of-pocket money. And once again, there was no risk to Mr. Domino because he did not have a contingent fee contract, and his results were not contingent, as his contract occurred at the time of the mediation, where Mr. Neyland had lived with this case for years. Mr. Domina offered no evidence outside of Mr. Johnson's testimony regarding Mr. Domina's experience, reputation, and ability. One of the things that I think that is important is when this case first came to hearing, there was no notice to Mr. Neyland of what was going on or what was attempted to be going on in the county court, and he found out on his own. Now, maybe Mr. Domina did or didn't have an obligation to reveal the results of the mediation, but certainly as a party and certainly as counsel of record, he was entitled to notice of the hearing in the county court. And yet Mr. Dominick's law firm chose to set this matter for hearing, substantially reducing Mr. Neyland's fee contract without notice to him at all. And I think that's appalling. The second thing that I think is appalling is this is the proposed settlement that Mr. Dominick had in a letter to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And you can see the Sheriff Gary Johnson here is in red. And the proposed, in the first settlement that they proposed to the county court, that you can see in red here how that share has grown. Mr. Johnson had two propositions to the court. This is the first one. After Mr. Nealon intervened and said there's something that needs to be done here, then the court appointed guardians ad litem, and the final distribution was more like this.
This is all how to divide up the $2.9 million after they'd gotten that.
That's correct, but part of it is that it wasn't until Mr. Nealon's fee was attacked that he went after this, and then there's two parts to that. First of all, once you challenge the client's fee, then he has to show what's the reason for it, and the reason for it would be that Garrett Johnson was seeking the lion's share for himself, and you heard that Mr. Johnson still feels the sting of the attack here, that he didn't get all this money. And the second thing is I'm not sure under the Perez case, if Mr. Nealon hadn't gone in and said something and spoke up so the children didn't get cheated here, that they wouldn't have been able to come back against him. So it's not only the right thing to do, he had an obligation to speak up for his fee, but also I think he might have been sued by the children under the Perez case had he not done that. And so Mr. Domina and Mr. Johnson are still complaining about that, but yet that's what Mr. Nealon did, and it's the right thing to do. And so if you look at what the county court did in the first go-around, the county court said that the 25% fee was all right and that Mr. Nealon should get 15% of that 25% fee. Mr. Domina was allocated the rest of it but got none of it because he clearly violated the ethical rules. And you can see why he clearly violated them in doing this without notice and not having either a contingent fee contract that was in writing or otherwise having an oral or written agreement within a reasonable period of time before representing the client. And what we analogized it to and what we from Mr. Johnson's letter is that it was more like they were joint venturers, but yet he chose to abandon Mr. Nealon at the mediation without telling him and then to seek a fee which would give him a very high fee without notice to Mr. Nealon and a very low fee to Mr. Nealon. A very low fee to Mr. Nealon without telling him about it. And if you look at what Mr. Domina says is fair now, he says it's fair to split the fee 50-50. In the initial division of the fee that Mr. Domina proposed, it was he got $290,000 and Mr. Nealon would get $145,000, but that included the $55,000 that he'd expended in expenses and out of pocket. And so there was over a 3-to-1 difference in the first go around, and you can see what Gary Johnson was doing. And what Mr. Nealon said is, well, we can't allow these children to be cheated. Plus, it's a fee dispute, so he has a right to go in and attack Mr. Johnson. But he could have been sued by the girls if this thing had happened. And that's one of those worst nightmare situations for any county judge, that somebody will come in ex parte without notice when they have an obligation to present all the true facts, even in an ex parte situation and the ethical rules, and that the children will get cheated. And that's what was prevented in this case. As far as the work that Mr. Nealon and Mr. Domina did, there was ample support for what the county court did because there was a risk premium here from Mr. Nealon. He had a written contingent fee agreement. There was no written agreement that Mr. Domina ever had. He had accurate, detailed records, accurate records of his cost. Mr. Domina estimated his cost would be about $1,000. And so if you look at the time and the money expended by Mr. Nealon, it is substantial. And there were substantial reasons for the county court's decision.
But a lot of that was for the economist, which Mr. Domina says he didn't want to use, right?
Well, it wasn't just the economist, because there were actually seven experts that were retained. There was a neuropsychologist. There was a psychologist for the family. There were other doctors that were retained. It wasn't just the economist. And,
however it's divided, each lawyer should get their costs.
Right. And those have already been paid, actually. That's clear. But there was a lot of work to go into that. And as you know, one of the things that's changed is that because of the way lawsuits are structured, you try to put everything you can into special damages. And loss of services for a wife and a mother are critical, and you need to put some value on them. And if you don't put some value on them, then you're just talking about stuff. And so that's why you have an economist come in and put a value on the loss of services. There were five expert written reports. If you look at the federal claim and what was substantiated, you can see why the county judge was less inclined to believe Mr. Johnson, because many of the things that he says weren't done are actually there in the federal claim, And they show that Mr. Johnson just misunderstood for whatever reason. Once again, Mr. Nealon had extensive documentary evidence, a lot of which is in the record. Mr. Nealon identified all the factual witnesses. He participated in the pretrial disclosures and submissions, and even wrote the trial brief in this particular case. And one of the things that Mr. Nealon did is, whenever he had a settlement demand or offer, he avoided the aggregate claims, which is one of the unfortunate things that led to the dispute in this. You wouldn't have that first pie chart with the big pie going to Gary Johnson at the time this was proposed to the county court without notice, if it had been settled as individual claims and not aggregate claims. And what the county judge did, as the court knows, is it allocated according to the intestate statute. And so this is a situation here where, if not for for Mr. Nealon and his counsel, the children would have been cheated, and Mr. Nealon would have had a substantially reduced fee. And so what we're saying is, what the county court did, and there are substantial reasons for what the county court did, was to follow what the court ordered on remand. We could go through the reasons why Mr. Domina did not get a fee in the first go-around. He failed to show the extent and value of his services. And Mr. Domina can say that analogized to earth-moving equipment, but what earth was moved in this? From the dancing around figure of $2 million, it went up to $900,000, and the county judge split the $900,000 50-50, and that's why he did it. Because Mr. Nealon proved all the elements that the court asked the county judge to go over on remand, and Mr. Domina chose to rely on Mr. Johnson. As we pointed out, the court saw Mr. Johnson live. The court rejected much of what Mr. Johnson had to say because it was not substantiated, and when you went down further and further and as to what the true facts were, the documents show that Mr. Johnson was inaccurate or often in error. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you need rebuttal, counsel?
1 minute if I had time. Okay. May it please the court, on the question of whether Gary Johnson knew about a $2 million offer, I believe the answer is on pages 96 through 98 of the transcript in his testimony. On the question of whether there was...
So what's the answer?
That he did not know about a $2 million offer. On the question of notice to Mr. Nealon, I frankly don't know what that argument's about. I just don't know what the accusation is. There were guardians ad litem appointed to protect the daughters. The guardian ad litems approved the 15% fee sponsored by Mr. Johnson and proposed by him. On the matter of whether I have suggested a division of the fee previously or now, I want to say only this. There is one line, paragraph 47, page 14 of the appellant's opening brief, that may indulge in some luxury about what I think. Otherwise, I presented Mr. Johnson's position on two-thirds and a third. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the arguments for this morning. The parties are excused. We are adjourned.